Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Welcome to episode 5 of the podcast. This one's going to be a little bit different, or maybe a lot different, depending on how you look at these things. Mick Haley interviewed Brian Gemellaro as part of an extension of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project that is going to focus on, for lack of a better term, pioneers in the coaching game. Those who come from the earlier generation of coaches, especially coming out of the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, who are essentially the forerunners of the coaches that are active or largely representative in the modern generation of coaching. Brian doesn't go back as far as others, like Mick himself, for example, but he is obviously somebody who's had a really interesting impact on the game, winning national championships at multiple levels. And for me, some of the more interesting stuff in this conversation has to do with the things that he did on what you could call the business side of coaching, or certainly the non-volleyball side of coaching, fundraising and business development and things like that, which are things I think are very relevant to especially college coaches today, but anybody in the business of volleyball, which is something that I want to make a regular feature of these conversations in this series. So, and there's also elements that I would call current events related that Brian brings up in the conversation, which is one of the reasons that I thought it would make a good podcast episode. So I think you'll really enjoy it. Before we get into the episode though, a quick shout out to Michael Reyna, who became the newest supporter of the podcast on Patreon. So thank you very much, Michael. You can become a supporter. Go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/coachingvb. And you can also find the link on the website and in the show notes if you ever need to get back there. So with that, let's get on with this discussion between Mick and Brian. Hope you enjoy.
We have Brian Gemellaro. Brian has won 3 NCAA Division I national championships, including the first undefeated team in NCAA history. Long Beach State also competed under his guidance in 8 NCAA Final Fours. He has the distinction of being the only coach in the U.S. who has won a national championship in high school, as a coach, in club as a coach, and college levels. His players were named to the U.S. Olympic team 16 times. 50 of his players went on to play international volleyball, and his players were named All-American teams 49 times during his tenure. Brian was named Big West Coach of the Year, Western Regional Coach of the Year, Northwestern Regional Coach of the Year, Volleyball Magazine Coach of the Year, ABCA Coach of the Year, the U.S. Olympic Committee Coach of the Year, and USA Volleyball All-Time Great Coach Award. Brian has been inducted into the ABCA Hall of Fame, the Southern California Indoor Volleyball Hall of Fame. He also started the Beach Volleyball Program at Long Beach State University and coached in the national championship match during his inaugural season. The following year, he directed his team to a national championship in beach collegiate volleyball. Brian was the president and owner of Cal Junior Volleyball Club for 30 years. This club won several national championships during his tenure. And Brian also served as business manager for the USA Women's Olympic team in 1983 and 84. He has coached over 2,000 matches in his career at all levels. He has been victorious in over 80% of his matches, which I think is probably the most impressive of all the things. Think about that, winning 8 out of 10 all the time. Brian has also been recognized by the City of Long Beach with several community awards, including Leader of the Year. He is well recognized as an author and speaker. His Volleyball Skills DVD series is among the best-selling in the history of the sport. Brian Gimolaro is with us today. I'm Mick Haley, and I have the privilege of being able to interview Brian through this whole fantastic history of volleyball. But Brian, I'd like to start and find out a little background about you. It's amazing to me all the things you've done, but where were you born?
I was born in, by the way, whoever that person was that you read about, I better be pretty good at this. Thanks, Mick. I was born in Utica, New York. It's part of the Mohawk Valley and the base of the Adirondack Mountains in New York.
And how long did you live out there?
I went through high school there and came out to California to go to college.
And in your high school experience, did you play volleyball on the East Coast?
Well, what was really funny, I'm funny you mentioned that. There was no volleyball, except at the end of basketball season, the basketball coach said, there's going to be a state volleyball championship. And we didn't even know what it was. And so the basketball team became the volleyball team. We practiced in the morning for 1 week, and we played at the end of the week in this kind of tournament format. We didn't even know the rules. So I played. We played one day.
That's the most amazing thing because, you know, some of the rest of us had the same experiences. I never played before I went to college myself. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how we all got into volleyball, and it's a very interesting story how you got into it. So you moved to the West Coast.
Yeah.
Where in particular did you move?
Well, I ended up in Belmont Shore, which is the beach part of Long Beach, the college town of Long Beach. And funny story is I had no expectations, didn't know what Long Beach State was, and ended up in the town. I thought I, you know, went to heaven. Here I'm walking down this beautiful beach street, and, you know, it's all people dressed in bathing suits and walking around. And the very same day I went up and applied at the school, and by pure luck and chance got in and ended up going to Long Beach State. It was because someone working in the line did me a lot of favors. We'll leave it at that. And I got in, and that's I ended up going to Long Beach State and living in the same, you know, vicinity. You know the area, Mick. You've lived here long enough. From Belmont Shore, I had an old house in Sunset Beach, but about a 5 mile radius. I've lived the whole time.
That's amazing. And that's been a few years.
That's been a few years, yeah. It's been a lot of years.
That's good. So one of the things that I heard you say is you were a basketball player. What other sports did you play before Long Beach?
I played in high school. I played football, basketball, and baseball. And I think I was the reverse of what most people say, and I kind of mean that. I thought I was a much worse player than I was. And as I got older and played here, I played in California. I played a lot of, you know, off-season, you know, sports because the weather was so good. I actually got better as I got older. And then I started playing, because of where I lived, I started playing beach volleyball. I actually played beach volleyball for 11 years. But I think the background in the other sports were really beneficial to me. I was always loves the technique of the sport, any sport, loves the strategy, loves the teamwork and camaraderie. I've always been taken by it. So, but I started playing after I got older, and actually 30, 22 to my 30s, I was playing beach volleyball.
So before you fell in love with volleyball, which I'm assuming mm-hmm. you did, mm-hmm. What was your love? I mean, did you have a particular sport? Did you, like all young guys, did you think you were going to be really good in one sport or going to try to be good in one sport? Or,
well, we were delusional when we were young. And, you know, I always thought that I could play anything. But my real love, I think, and it still is football. American football is just the strategy and the toughness and the it's a coach's dream, but a player's dream. I remember being in a huddle one time and looked around and guy looked around and he said, before he called the defensive signal, he looked around and says, is everybody okay? Because it was kind of a collision the play before. And I remember saying, he said, looked at everybody okay. And I'll never forget that. It was kind of like, we're in this together type thing. And I just thought, I've never had more fun playing a sport than that. It's so much fun playing that game, you know.
It's interesting. Former Olympic coach Pat Zartman, who coached the women's volleyball team for a while, went back to coaching football, and I think until a later part of his years. Yeah. The best part about us playing when we were younger is they didn't have videotape. They didn't have a lot of cameras. So we couldn't watch ourselves, so we could tell everybody we were really good at whatever.
I would love to get a hold of some of that. I don't know if it was Super 8, whatever. There was a little film, but, you know, I think I could have played every position because it was so far away, nobody knew who I was out there.
that's pretty cool. Well, I think that's pretty neat. So you get to Long Beach, you start playing. Well, what do you do for work? What kind of you go to school, you get your degree. What's your degree in?
I went to undergraduate school in economics and did a master's in economics. I did a, but I was a minor in political science and a minor in mathematics. And I really liked school. I didn't have any money, so I had to work full time and play and go to school full time. That was kind of a tough schedule, but I liked school and I liked studying and I liked the challenge of it. So I did it. I would have liked to have more money to be able to not have to work as much, but that was okay.
So what was your first job coming out of Long Beach?
My first job was I was a sales rep for General Mills because I couldn't get a job as a teacher. I wanted to teach, which most of the people that age wanted to do. After a year with General Mills, just about a year, I got a job teaching. And then I fell into this job with this multicultural educational group that was licensed by the Office of Civil Rights. And that was really important to me because I learned about so many of my biases and it framed the importance of education and frame some of my beliefs of today.
Do you ever feel like those early jobs, which you thought were just jobs, but you actually get experience in sales and selling? People know how important sales are as a coach, especially a collegiate coach. But there are.
Well, I had the sales. You did too. We did the same. If I interviewed you, the interview might be the same. You know, we should do that sometimes because you know, being a sales rep, you know, that was survival. So I had to be the best sales rep. Then when you went into school, went into teaching, you know, even in those days, keeping a job was very hard because there were so many cuts, but you know, walking into a school and telling them that you're going to help integrate the school, good luck. And you're bringing in a program that's going to make some changes. You're selling that program every single day. And then I became my buddy, who was my beach partner. We taught together and he was my beach partner. He started a high school program and talked me into coaching with him. And it wasn't my intention. And then we took a program that just started in Southern California. The only teams that won were a very few beach teams. It was a true beach sport at that time. And we were not a beach school. So we were not kind of accepted in that. So talk about selling, you better sell your product. And we turned that team into winning several Southern California championships and then a California championship. And we went all the way to being number one in the country. And right after that, I got the job in Long Beach State. But that was actually what ended up happening is my federal program ran out. And I ended up teaching at the school, and I taught several different subjects.
So being involved not only mm-hmm. in sales, but mm-hmm. the other position that you had mm-hmm. before you got into coaching mm-hmm. teaching at school, mm-hmm. how do you react to all the stuff that's happening today after all those years when you first got involved with that? And it seems like we've just gone full circle, for crying out loud.
In what way, Mick?
Well, just in civil rights and all of the things that are happening out there, right? You know, you and I have talked about this a number of times, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I guess I wasn't aware that you were involved even before you got into coaching. And one of the things about your coaching is you were one of the first, if not one of two people, maybe, that mm-hmm. really brought the black athlete into women's volleyball at a high level. And you were successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in 1985, I took over at Long Beach State. In 1989, we won the school's first NCAA championship in any sport, Division I championship. Oh. And it really was my proudest moment as a coach because no team had won a championship with more than one black woman of color starter on the team. And we won with five black women starters. So I was really proud of that. You know, I wasn't trying to do anything, you know, special, you know, in that regard. I just found a group of players that I admired how hard they worked. I admired their morality and their ethics and their loyalty and their fight and their skill and the desire to learn. And it turned out to be there was five black women starters. And I learned so much from that team and learned so much about so many things. And to get to your question, we have a problem in this country. There's no doubt about it. It's sad for me that we have to have a Black Lives Matter movement. You know, it's real, it's necessary, I support it, but it's embarrassing that in the United States, after all that we've gone through, that we have this. You know, if I can take a quick aside, I've been touring since I retired. I've been touring around the world quite a bit. And I remember the last few years before COVID, I went to Russia. And I remember sitting with a person in Russia, a very distinguished man. And I learned a little about Russian history and what a history that is, what they've gone through from being attacked from other places and from Peter the Great through Napoleon, through World War, the Revolution, the World War II, and Hitler. They lost 30 million people in World War II. Unbelievable. And when you look at all that, you go through Stalin all of that, you know, you go through communism and you survive all of that. And he looked at me and he said, given all that, this is what we have now, the government they have now. And, you know, how disappointing to go through all that and have Putin as your leader. And at the same time, my feeling is where our history is still shorter, but it's glorious. And people have done such great things in our history to make our country so special. This is not where we should be now. And certainly not in terms of our that black people in this country are systematically oppressed with racism. And this Black Lives Matter movement is necessary, and we need to get back to being Americans and striving for a more perfect union. That's my speech.
Well, I knew you would get on the soapbox. But it's well earned. Honestly, you really broke the barrier in women's collegiate volleyball. Yeah, maybe Antoinette White left USC and came to Long Beach. But think about that. That means that Long Beach is special. She leaves an Irby program that was dominating along with UCLA. Usually you'll see something like that happen. Somebody leaves and they'll go to the other school that's dominating. She didn't do that. She went to a Long Beach State and helped make Long Beach State dominating and heard of all over the country. And so I think that's one of the most special things. But it wasn't just what you did with your teams at Long Beach State. You also started a junior club. And what people don't realize is when you're developing players and you're developing kids, you develop the community. You had, 30 years at Cal Juniors where you ran that program. Some of the best club coaches and high school coaches in the country coached young kids, but everybody in Long Beach and anything associated with the Long Beach area came to play for Cal Juniors. And I can remember a time when Setter from San Diego drove to Long Beach every night, every Wednesday night to practice so that on Saturday she could play on one of the best club teams, Cal Juniors. And she came from a family of volleyball players that was really good. Tell me about that part of the development, because you just don't walk into a school and make them great with five or six players. It is a constant battle to educate the community, to get them behind and then do something special for the young kids. So you got your teams to go out into the community also and help build this. Talk about the Cal Juniors part of your career.
Well, first, Cal Juniors was started. You mentioned Chuck Irby. Him and Steve George were the people who started it, and that kind of fell apart. And this was before I went to Long Beach State, because once I was at Long Beach State, you couldn't bring in those players. But they came. They came. Tim Menealy became the top coach for us after Steve left. Chuck left right away first year, and then Steve left soon after that. But Tim Menealy became the head coach. My job was to, in those days, a coach, we made very little money. It wasn't about making money. It was about developing kids. We rarely got a kid from Cal Juniors to come to Long Beach State. In fact, the only ones that I got were kids that played for me in high school, or unrecruited kids. But you knew some unrecruited kids could be pretty good, supplementary roles. But what we did do was, the purpose of that club in those days was to make kids better, simply to make kids better. There was no such thing as a private lesson. Private lesson meant the coach came early or stayed late. That was a private lesson, There were no recruiting services. The coach made a video and sent it out But the coaches were just involved with the players, and players drove forever. And the difference, I think, today is club is more about recruiting than it is about teaching. So the ones, you recruit players so your club has the best team instead of teaching players. And that's really the change over time. And I don't really like that so much. I understand I like people making money, but I don't think that it's lost its reasoning.
How many youngsters did you have in that program over the 30 years?
I don't know. We averaged about 160 a year.
I mean, think so about that. So yeah. That's education in yep. sport. And what was the youngest teams you had when you first started?
When we first started, we were at 15s, but then it got down to 12s. 12s became – but early on, it was the majority were 18s. And 16s, and then it kept getting lower. But it was about 160 a year for 30 years. Yeah. It was a lot of kids.
Yeah, there were other clubs that that started up just with the idea they needed to wanted to beat Cal Juniors, the Orange County Group.
Right.
Just a ton of clubs that tried to do that.
We were one of the first, if not the one of the first in the country to be a privately owned club. I own the club, and that was usually run by boards. And I thought running a board for a club of parents is a major mistake. It's a conflict of interest. So I wrote it, you know, I owned it myself. I made a business out of it myself. As far as community goes, I think that, you know, go back to a high school, you know, in high school, I think that not only did we win, but we wrote our own write-ups for the local paper because they weren't going to send a reporter. So we were your own reporters. I'm sure you've done it. So you laugh because you promote your own. I remember, I think one of my distinctions in volleyball at the high school level is right on the corner of our school was the governing body. The Interscholastic Federation was right there. So the first playoff game one year, they came to the game that night. And they noticed that because of our promotions, and we promoted like crazy, we had everybody there. The stands were full. High school games, people didn't come. So now we have a full stands, right? And they're thinking, what the heck is this? You know, we got the football team there. We got everybody there. It only holds about 2,000 people. And we had at least 1,500 people were from our school. And it was a raucous crowd and fun, and everybody loved it. The very next day, CIF went back and said, they started to saying, now we're going to charge for the games. Yeah. So, and the following year, they spread out and had more divisions so they could have more games. They said it was for opportunity. I question that. I think it was for the gate that they found out that they could get. So that was funny. But let me say something about community. You do community, like I just said, you write your own articles, you talk it around the school until you get everybody excited about the players. You make a community feel out of it. But I went to Long Beach, and I mentioned this to you before privately. I spoke in my 32 years, and it was more than this, but I stopped keeping a journal at 379 speeches I made in the community and during my time. 379 speeches I made. And that's because you needed the support of your community. You needed them to follow. They needed to feel the teams at the university were part of that community. This university community was part of the entire community, and you had to push that all the time.
You know, I recently did a webinar for ABCA on what coaches should be doing with their found time during this COVID period. And not only should they be doing all the things you're talking about, but it's interesting. The programs that are successful over a long period of time get their players to invest in the community. They get their players to not only invest in each other, but they become part of something bigger than just the team. And other people want to gravitate towards that, but you don't let them just be part of it unless they're going to invest in it. So you had at the lowest levels, you were doing clinics, you were giving speeches, you were starting junior clubs to teach people, and I'm sure your players were also teaching these junior players, so they learned to give back to younger players, because we all did that when we were starting our programs. And that sales I talked about had a lot to do with that, because you were selling your sport. You also went to a higher level. In what years were you working with Ari Salinger and the national team as the business manager? I remember when I was recruited to Cosmo, you were there at that particular time doing some work with Ari, and I had stopped in to watch practice, and and you came in, and I asked you the question, how come you carried the briefcase?
And you said, well, Ari was pretty spontaneous, so if he suddenly said he wanted this, you better have it with you, you know, so I carried my briefcase. But, because he said, you never knew. you never knew what he was going to ask about. I love that team. You know, I've never really committed myself to writing a book, but I've written a book, but I always committed myself to writing a book about that team, calling it the last amateur team in the country, in the world, the last amateur team in the world. And that's really, I was so inspired by them because they worked so hard behind the scenes, harder than anybody can imagine. They were going 6 hours to 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. They would spend 7 months of the year out of the country because the competition, you needed to go outside of the country to be in competition. It was the one sport for women that many countries allowed the women to play, really before the U.S. got organized. You know, the Soviet Union was organized, Japan was organized, Brazil, Cuba, China, Korea, they were really organized, Poland, allowed women to play. But in this country, women played late, so it was always a game of catch-up, and I really enjoyed them. My job, I felt, was simply because they were amateurs and because they had no money to find a way to supplement them financially.
And so that involvement then also gave you another level of volleyball expertise to share with your players, and young players who were looking to try to become as good as they could be would take a serious look at Long Beach because
things. I did it out of just goodness in terms of I didn't even know if I was going to be a coach. I didn't really care that much about coaching. I really cared about that team. And I found Ari to be brilliant. And I spent many times with him at a restaurant table with ketchup bottles, I'm sure you have, and salt shakers. And this is your middle blocker. And this is your left side hitter. And, you know, I found him to be brilliant. And the way he looked at the sport was different than anyone else did.
Recruited an awfully good assistant coach from that team also.
Oh, yeah. Debbie Green and Rita Crockett came to me. When I went to Long Beach, my first semester, I got hired July 31st, and practice started August 1st. So I met the team, and we started practicing. And they didn't have any money for an assistant coach. So I wore a suit, warmed up the team, warmed up the team, got sweaty, put my suit on, and was the head coach and assistant coach and everything for the first semester during the season. And by the way, we went to the NCAA playoffs for the first time in the school's history that year, but it was a busy year. And then in January, both Debbie and Rita came. Both of them joined the staff. Rita's still a coach, and Debbie said, I'll be with you 1 year to give back to you, Brian, but I'm done after 1 year. And that was 23 years later, she lived up to that. But Debbie's a great coach and a great friend.
Well, and this all fits together the way I see it. I think coaches listening to this out here have to understand the investment that you need to make if you want to become successful. You don't win 80% of your games for life if you're not invested. And then there's more. You shared with me at one time how you and your wife, after every match, would go out with boosters, 20, 30 boosters, and dinner after the matches, and you were encouraged and did go around to every table, talk to almost every booster every night. And that's usually 16 to 18 home matches, times out in the fall. I mean, that is a large chunk of your entire life that you're investing in that. And that's why you're one of the all-time great coaches ever, because not only the investment, but you not only inspired your team, in some cases drove your teams to the success that they all talked about, but didn't really know whether they could or not. and then offering opportunities to every young lady out there, no matter of a race or anything like that. It's just a tremendous story, and I'm so pleased that I get to help talk about it a little bit. Tell me about your first national championship, though. You know, you think about this. Your guy from New York comes to Long Beach. The first thing they do is call you a hack, for sure, because you're not in part of the group there in Southern California, right? You got to have the blonde hair and the blue eyes, and it's got to be down back of your neck, and you're thinking Von Hagen and Selznick, and you're thinking all of that, and you earn respect by just going out there and beating that ball around, and then you get in the high school gym and you earn respect there. Then Long Beach gives you a shot. You earn respect there. Not only that, you bring in athletes that have not been allowed or had an opportunity to be taught to play at a high level with that kind of athleticism. You know, then you take the whole community. And not only that, one of the most impressive things is when the mayor wants to honor you for what you've done for the community. I mean, that's above and beyond winning games. That's making a community feel proud that they have people in their community that adds value to living there. That's really special. But that first team, I mean, you always think you're going to have a chance to win, but you always know why you're not going to win, because the coach knows better than anybody else where your mm-hmm. where your weak points are. Mm-hmm. The first one, though, is always seems to me to be pretty special. You got any thoughts about that team at all?
Well, that team was special, and we talked about it, but I learned so much. I learned about pride and about working together. And yes, it was special. I want to say something because, like I said before, I could be doing this interview with you and it would be the same. In fact, we could just reverse the questions. But I wanted to tell, because you mentioned it, I wanted to say something about what you need to do. You can't figure out what you don't have. You know, if you start thinking about what you don't have.
That's right.
I was on a speaking tour around the country for years. I made money speaking. I sold a hell of a lot of DVDs. It was great. But the reason I did it is because we had to get the word out. We didn't have the publicity department. We didn't have a football program. We didn't have a way to put Long Beach State on people's lips. You know, people didn't wear Long Beach State hats. You know, it was always an uphill thing. So that was one thing I did. Secondly is I knew the community, and we had a booster club to raise money because we needed it. And after we had an AD come in and say no more booster clubs, that wasn't his thing. So I had to find a new way to raise money. Now I'll say this, and I used to lie about it. You know, I never told our players, because I always raised enough money. But the coaches, the coaches organization did a survey of budgets, and we didn't turn in ours because I didn't want to. But about 280 schools turned in budgets, and we were $10,000 less than the smallest budget there. We had $10,000 less than the smallest budget in the country. But we had Mizuno, and Mizuno outfitted us better than anybody, free, anything we wanted. That was from years of knowing Mizuno. And we got Baden behind us, so we had that. So the equipment was taken care of. And then I raised money, but I was raising to just get by. I was raising over $100,000 a year just to get by. Now, I told the players we had all the money. We had the biggest budget, not the smallest budget, but we did. In the end, in the last years or so, we still won 80% of our matches, but we couldn't get to be a top team anymore. And one of the things that happened at the university was they took away out-of-state scholarships. We used to be able to bring in a player from out-of-state and roll them over in 1 year and make him an in-state student. And we weren't allowed to do that anymore. So, oh my goodness, you know, we survived on out-of-state kids. So it became more and more difficult. We were able to get foreign kids who, if they were in the top 10% of the incoming class academically, they were allowed, they were counted, given an exemption, and were counted as an in-state. So we had to go out of the country and find good players that were good students. And that became very difficult. So it was, it was difficult at the end, but every year, and you had to raise, I had to raise 100 and some thousand a year. Then I started the beach program against the president's wishes, but we started, but I told them no budget, no salary, no scholarships. And we won by me fundraising the money to do, to run a program. So we won a national championship with no scholarships, no salaries, and no budget. So that was, you just don't complain about what you don't have. You know, you just go and do it.
That's, and I think the hardest thing, you know, we were the first school at USC to start a women's beach program, and I mm-hmm. was in charge of it.
I remember.
And that's the worst thing I ever got into. Like, I have nothing but ultimate admiration for you, because, you know, when you first start a program like that, and beach players and beach coaches, they don't have any rules. They've never had any rules. And you're trying to impose NCAA rules to get a program started that has some kind of, oh my, that was just, when I was able to get a beach coach and get out of that, I was in hog. I tell you, that was the hardest thing. So you not only started it, but you won mm-hmm. a national championship early, and mm-hmm. to your credit, that is the toughest thing to do. You know, Stanford couldn't do it. A lot of people that tried to take their indoor teams outside couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was our indoor team. We took our indoor team and put them out there because we didn't have any money to bring in anybody.
So that was even more special, it seems to me. So when you look at that, you look at all of that work. Anything you've taken on, you've reached the pinnacle pretty much mm-hmm. Of success. And now you're even doing teaching, part of a master coaches group that is doing clinics and virtual kinds of things, probably coming up with more new ideas, even on recruiting and evaluation and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Master coaches is you and me. And we talked about it and started it. You started it with Bob Bertucci and Ruth Nelson. And it's a really good, it's a caring group. That's why I'm involved. It cares about the sport and cares about the development of young people and helping coaches. And so I'm involved with that now. I've done 3 seasons now on a small level, but it's the level I want with ESPN. Announcing games, and I think that I'm good at it because I add, you know, I don't treat volleyball as a foreign sport, and I talk to people who might even know something about volleyball. I don't say, you know, ridiculous things. This is 3 out of 5 and things like that. I talk about
great
the sport, the strategy.
Great slam.
Great slam. And I've really been treated well with that, and I enjoy doing that. I really enjoy doing it. We'll see if we ever do it again. Who knows, you know?
That's right. Who knows? But you have to think positive, and I think that's what you've always done, is found the positive part and gone forward with it. And it's been exciting to watch. I can remember wanting to race down from my bench and jump on you and put my hands around your neck and strangle you when we're having these great matches back and forth. But after it's all over, it's such an appreciation to get in battles like that with coaches. And to give you some kudos there, we won our first national championship at Texas in 1988, And you were one of the teams that beat us at Illinois that year in a four-team tournament that we had up there. Taught us a lot and made us change a little bit, not only our tactics, but the way we were training to get even better by the end of the season. So you came to the Midwest to play. I came to the Midwest from Texas to play. We were willing to go anywhere to promote the sport. Mike Hebert was really trying to produce a winner at Illinois, and he was filling the stands with those people. You know, you didn't just stay in Long Beach. And let me ask you another thing about being the little sister, so to speak. So you're in Long Beach, but really Long Beach is right next to Los Angeles. Right? Yeah. And yeah. All around you. And sure. you've got the two behemoths, UCLA and USC, and everybody either wants to go to one or the other.
Sure.
And you take Long Beach and win a championship, and of course that ruffles some feathers. Then you win a couple more championships, and that ruffles a lot of feathers. And how did you keep your head up? Because, you know, they're throwing darts at you when you're amps, when you're moving forward. You make people uncomfortable. And people don't like to be uncomfortable. They like status quo, right? They like everything.
Sure.
And you muscled in and did it in a way that it was so good because your teams executed, if not as well as those teams, better than those teams, with athletes that were so fun to watch. And now with the I just wonder what your athletes would make if they had NIL things coming. You had your athletes, because everybody would be wearing a beach shirt, everybody would be wearing Danielle Scott jersey or Misty May jersey or those kinds of things. So I don't know how you handled all that. Do you have anything to say about all of that?
About the NLI?
Yeah, about that. All the Los Angeles.
Well, what I found, we were called names, when we won as a program.
Sure.
We were also called, I was smart enough, or I don't know if the word is smart, but I stayed away from all of that because, people thought I was one person that I wasn't. I've always been the same guy. I compete really hard like you do. And like all good coaches do, and like John Wooden did, he was a heck of a competitor. You compete as hard as you can, and then when it's over, you go back to being yourself. You are, part of you is that competitor. You don't have to defend it. That's who you are. That's the good part. And what people say about you, they say. They're going to believe what they want to believe. But I know the people I interacted with. For example, at my retirement dinner, not only did, Tara and Danielle and Debbie Green and Misty May got up and spoke. We tried to limit that. But I also had, there's 60 players there, and it sold out. There's 700 people or 600 people. And it was expensive, so I don't know. I don't know whether anybody got the money. But people came from, I had players come from 13 different states to come back to my retirement. But what I thought was so special was we had an ex-mayor speak. The current mayor couldn't be there, so he sent a letter. We had three presidents. Two of them sent a letter, and one did a video there. We had two ADs get up and speak. So I was represented by the mayors and the presidents. And my athletic directors and fellow coaches, and most of all, and most importantly, players. So the people who knew me, who, I was in their community, who knew me as a person, knew who I was. That, but when you get out and you compete and you win in an arena which they don't want you to win, You're not accepted as, you're not USC, you're not UCLA, you're not Texas, you're not Florida, you're not Notre Dame or Penn State or, all those other schools, and you win. you are going to take some brunt of it. But I really didn't care. I care what people think about me, but I knew who I was and I knew how I act and I know what I believe in. And I know that I'm honorable. So if somebody says that's what they have to say, good for them.
Well, I think one of the things that has been most fun, you know, with Master Coaches working on John Foreman's platform to get our opinions out and information about the sport. But one of the things that's come from this is, wow, Brian Gimolaro is a lot of fun. Because people, when you're competing like that and trying to win every year, you're not really laughing it up and high-fiving spectators and doing all of that stuff. Yeah. And people draw conclusions, like when I don't smile, people think I'm angry. Well, you know, it hurts your cheeks. You smile. you want to focus on what you do best. And I think you did that so well that people drew some conclusions. They don't know how funny you are. They don't know how you have certain feelings that are very special for people. I hope this interview has brought out a number of those things, because I think over your career and the specialness that you've given back to the sport and all of your athletes and all the spectators that have enjoyed watching your teams, that is really something that I would hate to not have people get to see a little bit. So our little
thank you
buzz that we do afterwards, we give you a hard time, you give us a hard time. We have a heck of a lot of fun with that.
No, I think, like I said earlier, first, thank you, Mick. Thank you for doing this. And you're so good at it. You know, maybe you should have done the opposite. You should have. But I do say that you could have been that I could have done the same interview with you. And when you're a head coach, you make the tough decisions. We've talked about this, you and me, and they're not popular a lot of times. But that's your job and my job, so you have to do it. You know, we're not in that role anymore. And, you know, 90% of my time, I wasn't in that role. 10% of my life or 20% of the day, or maybe a little more than that, I was in that, you know, your head coach. And the rest of the time, you can be you. I've gotten to know you and your wife, and she's a crack up. And I enjoy your company, and I enjoy your company, and it's been fun getting to know you. But thank you for this interview.
Do you have any other thing that I might have overlooked or missed here that you'd like to share? Because as coaching conversations go, this has been certainly one of the most fun for me to be involved in. And I want to make sure that I don't leave one thing out that that you think is important here.
Well, I want to say one more thing. When I retired, people said, my God, you retired. First, it wasn't fast. It was, you know, the idea that when you retire, when you think about it, you should do it. But I've been thinking about it a long time. But I will say this. The number one reason I retired is I wanted to figure out what I was going to do when I grow up.
Yeah. You know, I mean, very good, because I always thought the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, we shouldn't lose that when we're little kids. I still feel the same way. I wonder what I'm going to do when I grow up. Anyway, thank you, Mick.
Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingvb.com, for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog of prior coaching conversation. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingvb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingvb.com, tweet them to @coachingvb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.